It's my absolute pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Imogen Wright. Imogen, as you can read in her bio, has done a number of fantastic things, including in bioinformatics and with a startup company, Hyrax Biosciences in South Africa. But the most amazing thing about her history is that for those of you that are Sci students here, she was one of you. So Imogen, although her story is a little bit different in the sense that when Imogen came to Sci, it was the first time Sci existed. So she took an amazing risk. Instead of going to a conventional graduate program, which had a well, you know, earned and well-defined reputation, she said, hey, this looks neat, I'm gonna try this. And it could have been a disaster, that would have been on her CV forever if she kept to. But hopefully instead, it hasn't been that. She came, she was valedictorian of the class, she was a huge part of that class, and has gone on to be very successful in what she's done since then. And so today she's gonna tell you the story of how she went from Sci student in the old building to where she is now. Imogen?
Hi. It's really, really good to be back. This is a really special place and very, very warm to my heart. The truth is, I don't think I could get into Sci now, so I took the risk correctly. I'm going to speak for about 30 minutes and try and leave about 15 for questions, so please do think of some questions. When I talk to school children, I usually have chocolate bars for questions, but I figure you guys are internally self-motivated, so we should be okay. No pressure. I'd like to, if you'll indulge me, start by picking up a little bit where I left off nearly 10 years ago on this stage. I gave a valedictory address as a member of the inaugural class of Perimeter Scholars International nearly 10 years ago on this stage, and I ended it with a comment about the value of theoretical physics as a unifying force for humanity, which is exactly the sort of thing that 23-year-olds have a tendency to say. But it's really heartening to me to realize that nearly 10 years later, I do in fact still agree with that little proto-me. So I'd like to start by saying that even though I'm about to tell a story about leaving theoretical physics and going and doing a bunch of different things and ultimately starting a company, if you want to do theoretical physics, you should do that. And don't let anything stand in your way. The rest of us muck around in the dirt in order to lift up the fine arts and the pure sciences. You're our hands and our eyes. So please, please don't give up on your dream if that is, in fact, your dream. I'd like to maybe start, though, by painting a picture of the person who was on this stage, because it's important you understand her to figure out where I got to. I come from a very small town in the poorest province of South Africa. So arriving at Perimeter was, as I was just saying to James, a little bit of a shock to my system. It was an academic shock. I was a little bit behind. It was a culture shock. And it was, possibly more than anything, a resource richness shock. Both intellectual and academic resources, and just practically. I can remember taking photos of the vending machines in the University of Waterloo cafeteria because I'd never seen such a fancy vending machine before. It was difficult and complicated year for me, but I left, I think, because of those shocks rather than in spite of them, with some really important lessons. I think the first thing I got out of Sci was a sense of mastery. A sense that I'd taken on something that was much too difficult for me and more or less prevailed. And I think that's a really special thing that theoretical physics in general can give us in terms of innate confidence. I think something else that I took was I had a much better sense of the shape of the world when I left here than when I arrived. There's a sort of easy internationalism that pervades this place that it's almost a cliche to say and I think maybe even a self-fulfilling prophecy to say that we live in a world that's more divided than ever. But I think places like this are to be celebrated, and I'm grateful for that. But I also left here with a real sense that I had experienced lack of lack very deeply in this place, in a lot of ways. And experiencing that lack of lack kicked off a kind of crisis of meaning that I think people who can remember me from that time can remember me struggling with a lot. Kind of, what am I doing here, doing theoretical physics when there are real practical problems out in the world, out where I come from, that need solving? And so by the end of my Psi year, one of the gifts that it gave me was realizing that that was enough theoretical physics for me. What I didn't know was what I wanted to do next. So I took the logical interim next step. My undergrad had been in physics and computer science. So I became a software developer. I worked for Amazon.com for about a year. I learned a lot from that place. I particularly learned that if you get woken up in the middle of the night every single night for a week straight because the computers are broken, you're going to start to hate the computers. On-call rotations were not, it turns out, entirely for my temperament. So after about a year, I left Amazon for a change of pace, and I went to London, and I worked for a small startup, kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. And it was here that I arrived at, you might say, on-paper happiness. I had a job that was pretty much exactly challenging enough. I had a lot of friends, I had a lovely flat, I was making a decent amount of money, I was having a lot of fun, I was having too much fun, and I was kind of miserable, to be honest. There's nothing quite so stark as having all the boxes ticked to, and still being somewhat unhappy, to show you what's missing in your life. And I think that the main reason that I was so unhappy was I was still fighting that crisis of meaning. So I, again, looked around for something else to do. And you're probably all going to be sold this at least once, that having a lot of weird, patchy things at the beginning of your CV is a bad scene. That's nonsense. Just ignore that advice completely every time it comes up. I actually get worried when young people come to me and they haven't done enough by the time their CV arrives on my desk, because I know that we're just going to be a jump, and there'll be several more. So please do explore. For me, my exploration, I was looking for three things. I really wanted to go back to South Africa because it was becoming apparent to me that it was possible that my crisis of meaning was quite thinly disguised homesickness. I really wanted to do something computational because I felt like that was where my strengths lay. I feel like I want to confess something very loudly on the stage that I can now confess because I'm big and ugly. I'm not that good at math. I was good enough, but the computers speak to me much, much better. And finally, I wanted to do something that could fall into the box of saving the world. Because I figured that the way that you get meaning in your life is by saving the world, which is also a really great thing to think when you're 23, 24, 25. I'd like to come back to that at the end of my talk and reassess that assumption. So I was Googling around kind of both work and academic positions in South Africa, and I came across a researcher who was doing computational work into the evolution of HIV. And I thought, hang, this ticks all the boxes. It's in South Africa, it's computational, and in a South African context, working on HIV is about as meaningful as you can get. So I dropped him an email on spec. He is now the co-founder and CEO of my company, and he still likes to bring this email out and read it to me when he wants to irritate me. I essentially said, I come from a physics background, and I've got some software development. I know absolutely nothing about biology, but what you do sounds interesting. Would you please give me a job? And he was either feeling very magnanimous, or he just had an entrepreneurial spirit even then, because he did say yes. And so I went back to South Africa, and he took on the difficult task of teaching a physicist biology and humility at the same time. and particularly to introduce me to HIV. So I'm going to quickly introduce you to HIV for the purposes of this talk. For the purposes of this talk, HIV looks like this. It gets into your body, it replicates itself by means of destroying your immune system, and it's a bad scene. If you are HIV positive, diagnosed now in South Africa, we will immediately give you antiretroviral drugs. And those antiretroviral drugs will destroy the HIV in your bloodstream, chase it back into something called the viral reservoir, and your immune system will recover, you'll no longer be immunocompromised, and ideally you would live out then the full term of your natural life. In practice, that's not exactly what happens. And the reason it's not exactly what happens is because HIV evolves very quickly. It doesn't take a lot for a small change, a small mutation to occur that converts regular common or garden HIV into the HIV equivalent of Iron Man, a drug-resistant strain of HIV that is resistant to most antiretroviral drugs. The trouble is, not all the HIV in your body needs to be resistant to drugs for it to be a problem. Because if you've got even a little bit of resistant virus in your body, if we give you antiretroviral drugs, all the susceptible virus dies, the resistant strain explodes in your body, and now not only are your antiretroviral drugs not working, but this is the strain that you will transmit. So this is not just an individual problem, it's a growing public health crisis. And I could say this about HIV, but I could also say it about TB, I could say it about staph, I could say it about pneumonococcus. This is gonna be one of the greatest arms races that we've ever engaged in as a species. It's an arms race against evolution, and evolution has a tendency to win. So what do you need in an arms race? Those of you who were alive in the Cold War, you need spies. You need something that can go into a human body, read all the DNA of all the HIV that's floating around in there, and report back what drugs will work and what drugs won't. So in 2012, we were aware that we needed a spy like this, and we were aware that it was going to have something to do with a DNA sequencing machine. DNA sequencing machines are how you read DNA. But we weren't entirely sure what was supposed to go between the DNA sequencing machine and this final drug resistance report. So that question mark became my PhD thesis. I'm not going to go into too much detail about exactly what that entails. You can ask me afterwards at your peril, because have you ever asked somebody about their PhD thesis? I haven't talked about it in a long time. I've got a lot of backlog building up. I'll give you one analogy. So I want to show you a little bit about at least what the data look like, because there are a lot of technical people in this audience. You know how when a layman thinks about the cosmic microwave background anisotropy, they think of this, but some people in this room might actually be thinking of that. And that's a much more appealing picture. When most people think of DNA, they probably think of something really shiny like this. Please Google biologist stock photos. I eventually didn't put them up, but it's great. I mostly think of this, a little bit different. So every DNA sequencing run produces about 50 gigabytes of junk like this. And every line on that screen is a tiny, random, slightly incorrect puzzle piece of the puzzle of the genome that you're trying to assemble, which makes the process of diagnosing drug resistance a bit like playing a game of spot the difference, except one side of your spot the difference puzzle is cut up into puzzle pieces. Some of those pieces are missing or broken. And also you have 50 billion puzzle pieces. Most of them come from a completely different puzzle that you're not interested in at all, and you only have 10 minutes to assemble it. Good luck. Again, I won't go into too much detail about how we solved this problem. I will say one thing that I learned from physics that definitely helped my thinking. In radio astronomy, what's the first step when you're processing data? Model and subtract the instrument. So modeling and subtracting the effect of the DNA sequencing machine was a big part of how we managed to get ahead in designing these systems. It took about 2 years for us to get to a place where we could diagnose HIV drug resistance in a person if only 1% of the HIV in their body was resistant to the drugs, which meant we'd finally found an accurate enough spy. We called that spy Exotype. We were quite proud of it. As a research group, we were sort of chuffed. And so we took it to our university's technology transfer office. And we said, okay, so we've built this piece of software. We think it might be useful in pathology labs and other places to diagnose drug resistance in HIV. But we're nice people, so we want to give it away completely for free. And the technology transfer office went, cute. How exactly are you going to support this software? How are you going to market it? How are people going to find out about it? What happens if one of you leaves the university? And we realized we'd slightly misunderstood how the world works and what commerce is for. There are two routes that you can take if you're in a university context and you invent something that might be practically useful. The sane route is you patent it, the university owns the patent, and the university then decides if they're going to commercialize it, if they're going to make a company out of it. That's not what we did, because we're not sane. We were absolutely determined that we were going to see the maximum possible accessibility for drug resistance testing in sub-Saharan Africa and in the world. And because we were very type A, we figured that the best way to achieve that would be to keep control of the intellectual property and start the company ourselves. So four of us took the leap out of academia towards starting a company. We finally incorporated it properly at the beginning of 2015, and we now had a piece of software, and we had a piece of paper that said we were a company. We called the company Hyrax Biosciences. And we obviously thought that that meant that we were done, because we have software and we have a piece of paper that says we're a company. So obviously now we just start selling things and everything goes happily from there. I really, really enjoyed the pit of despair analogy in the first presentation. That was great. We realized a few things. The first thing we realized is that our software was not a product. A product is something you can sell. Selling software is, hard is the easy version of that. So we ended up making a web service that people could upload their data to, which turned out to be a much better model. And we thought we'd solved that problem. We were quite proud. And then we realized that our product also wasn't a company. A company, it turns out, isn't a piece of paper. It's quite a complicated organism. It has a lot of moving parts. And we didn't even know what any of those parts were. We were so naive in the beginning of this journey that we didn't even know what questions to ask in interviews to hire the business people who could tell us what we didn't know. It's kind of a bootstrap issue. And finally, we were a South African company, and a lot of the world's public health decisions are made in the US, and the US has a tendency to favor their own. So we spent a lot of time getting doors slammed in our faces in the beginning, and that was difficult. I think it's prompted a lot of internal soul searching in all of the founders. I'll tell you what it looked like for me. The first question that I had to ask myself quite seriously is, do I actually like people? A lot of people go into science because they never want to talk to people ever again. And when you become an entrepreneur, that's not possible anymore. I now basically only talk to people. That's my job. I talk to customers, I talk to investors, I talk to employees. It's kind of 90% of my time is spent talking. I've come around mostly to most people most of the time. An even deeper question that I had to ask myself is, do I believe in this thing that I made enough to confidently ask people to pay for it? I'm not by nature somebody who believes in anything that I make very much, which makes me a good scientist, but not necessarily innately a good entrepreneur. So I kind of had to fake it until such time as there were enough people who were paying for our software that it became abundantly obvious to me that asking more people to pay for it wasn't a terrible idea. It's a really difficult road in the beginning, striking out on your own and starting a company. It's not like there is a nice mark sheet at the end of the day where you can go, okay, well, I got 80% at this day. You're mostly just banging your head against a brick wall and hoping for the best. But before I put you off too much, let me tell you why I would do it again in a heartbeat, why if this one falls over, I'm going to do another one, and why I would actively encourage all of you to think about it seriously as a career path. The first reason, I'm going to say this sentence, and if it doesn't strike home with any of you, please come talk to me afterwards and I'll knock some sense into you. Every single person in this room is well-resourced and well-educated enough that world-changing ideas are within our reach. Every single one of us. And all a company kind of is a vehicle to bring an idea into the world. And there is nothing more satisfying than waking up every morning and watching your idea every day be a little bit more in the world. On a similar tack, every single one of us is a very powerful instrument, which means that we're all going to be force multipliers for something in our lives. There is going to be a lot more of something in the world when we leave it than there was when we entered it. And a company is just a way to have the biggest possible vote over what that thing might be. Those are two maybe slightly altruistic reasons to start a company. Let me give you a very selfish one. Because you're all powerful instruments, if you don't direct your life towards your goals, somebody is going to use you to achieve theirs. Guaranteed. And that's okay. That's the transaction of capitalism. That's how it works. But I'd like you to think carefully before you take that route. I promised a little while ago that I'd say something about reassessing what I think meaning is from the approach that I had to it when I was 25. I no longer think that you necessarily need to save the world to achieve meaning, which is a good thing. I think that a lot of meaning in life just comes from seeing something very heavy that needs picking it up and carrying it as far as you can. We picked up two quite heavy things when we decided to start a company ourselves. The first thing that we picked up was total scientific integrity, which means that we validate our software more than our customers ask us to. We, in the strict analysis of commerce, waste time validating our software because it's that important to us. The second thing that we picked up was maximum possible accessibility, which means that we price our software differently from we would if we were only focused on profit. What's kind of been interesting to me is that it's because of, and not in spite of, picking up those two very heavy things, that we're on track within the year for 250,000 people who did not previously have access to an HIV drug resistance test to get one using our software just in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think it's possibly about to get even more exciting than that. In 2012, there was a prejudice in biology that HIV was very different from everything else. HIV evolves quickly, HIV has minor variants, you need to look at all the DNA in HIV and you need to treat it individually. Whereas everything else is completely homogeneous and you can just treat it in aggregate. And there was this big kind of divide. And we've since realized that that was very much a case of looking for your car keys under the streetlight because that's where the light is, as opposed to wandering off into the dark. It now turns out that bacteria have minor variants, and we're launching a TB drug resistance test in just a few weeks. And what will be coming in the future, I think, there is one very particular case where human DNA behaves quite a lot like HIV. It's when you have cancer. Cancer evolves quickly. It mutates. It has minor variants. It develops resistance to chemotherapy, which is essentially how it progresses. It's fascinating to me that it's particularly because we shunned working on diseases of the developed world and focused on HIV that we may now accidentally be half a decade ahead of the game in the race to develop a blood test for cancer, which is pretty cool. In closing, I think if there's one thing that I'd really like you to take away from this talk, it's that you have more choice and more capacity to make those choices than you can absolutely, possibly imagine. There is more openness to the world than you could ever see. It's only in retrospect, when we look back, that we see all the paths that we didn't take. And I suppose what I hope for you in going through that is that you choose something that has meaning for you. Thank you very much. Questions?
One thing that amazed me is the way you've been able to keep control of the company to shape things the way they should be to benefit society at large. The question, how did you manage to keep investors happy to give you money even if you don't have maximum profitability? Because that's probably like a, not a fight, but maybe a trade-off there.
So the trick is choosing the right partners, I think. So we were very lucky in that we got a wonderful grant from the South African Medical Research Council. They have a kind of venture capital-ish wing called the Strategic Health Innovation Partnership, and they are very keen to have, impact as well as just financial resources be the goal. And there are a lot of investors who operate in that space, and that's where we go.
One of the complications of people who go through the path that you went is when you invent something in university and you want to leave and have a company out of it, there are a lot of IP complications. How did you navigate those?
So the university licensed our intellectual property to us. The IP space is exceptionally complicated, but we've been very lucky in our partners and moving through that in that way. It's good to always watch that and always be concerned about it. Intellectual property is it's kind of the frustrating bugbear of this whole story in some sense. But you've got to play that well.
Do you ever hear resistance to a previously administered class of drugs diminish when you switch, or is it always accumulative?
Good question. So the question is basically, if you take drug A and then you're resistant to it and then you get given drug B instead because you're resistant to drug A, will resistance to drug A diminish? Quite a lot of resistance mutations make the virus less fit. So it's possible that you can partly wash out resistance by removing the evolutionary pressure. But because HIV writes itself back into your DNA, there's essentially a historical record of pretty much all the HIV you've ever had in your body. So it's quite controversial whether or not this is going to work. It's still underway.
Now you said that you spend 90% of the time talking to people, and you think the same thing can apply to bacteria and other things. Like, who's going to do the research?
Oh, man, good question. So being able to get things done efficiently through other people is a frustrating part of growing up, but... But so essentially we have a fantastic team, and they will, I really hope, and I think this is also something that people at my stage of career, I really hope that I will be able to do more research in the future when, and fill in the blank after when. But I think that relying on a team and being able to say and do small things to guide people in the right direction is...
It's like a PhD supervisor for the team, kind of.
Yeah. The reward for doing a lot of good science is that you get to watch other people do a lot of good science. I should have brought chocolate bars, man.
Now, I just wanted to ask if your physics had actually helped you at all.
Nice. I think, well, I'm obviously going to say yes. But I really do think yes. One way that I put it in, I think, a previous conversation that I had with Perimeter was whatever you're doing, being able to think simultaneously at different levels of abstraction is massively important. I found that translated very well to biology, where you're thinking about things in aggregate and individually at the same time. And I think it translates also very well to business. I think somebody talked about physicists being able to go to first principles. And also just seeing everything as a problem to be solved is really, really, really useful life skill that physics teaches you. Because physics is, well, my experience of physics is reading a question and being like, that's absolutely, definitely impossible. There's no way I'm going to be able to do that. And 45 minutes, like 30 to 40% of the time, having solved it. So that spirit is very important, yeah.
You talked about holding your team and yourself to a higher software validation standard. Mm. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. It's kind of technical and practical, but we didn't know in the beginning how to validate our software because nobody could measure things as accurately as we could. So it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. How do you validate the most accurate thing in the market? So we ended up essentially building the most complicated HIV drug resistance simulation that I think currently still exists, just in order to test that we could be as accurate as we are. And now we're very hopeful that that simulation will be used as a gold standard by regulators to set a bar for finding minor variants in DNA, because it's a new field and we think that we're in a good place with it. So it's spending as much time building the machine that can test your machine as your machine is it's very humbling and sobering to realize that sometimes that's what you've got to do, but that's what we had to do, so we did it.
I'm allowed to ask a question, right?
You totally
okay,
are.
So in terms of all the things you learn, say, in your undergraduate, in your graduate studies, and now, like you said, you're doing something very different, you're talking to people most of the time, what's the one thing you wish you had learned as in all of your education that you wish you had learned that you have to do all the time now?
Ooh. I'm going to have to think about that for a sec. I think that we're often, and I think this is generally true of most careers and most fields, is that the reward for getting to a certain point in your career is you're suddenly put in charge of a bunch of people. Because obviously, sitting in a small dark room doing science for a decade is the perfect qualification for becoming essentially a manager. and I could probably have used just a little bit more preparation of what that was going to be like before it happened. And I generally think that I was quite lucky in that I worked in industry a bit and had good managers before I became a manager. So I could kind of see a little bit how it was done. But I think that a lot of maybe why some parts of science are quite unhealthy and why people end up with really unhealthy work habits and really unhealthy lives is because people get into positions of power in science and in business and in various parts of industry with no qualification to actually be in a position of power. And so that's something that I think I could have had more of that, yeah.
You're doing a lot of impressive work. Do you think you've found the meaning you were looking for? If yes, when and how? And if not, why?
Yes. I'm not entirely sure how and I'm not entirely sure why, but I know that I don't wake up in the morning and go, what am I doing? Kind of ever. And I think that does have something to do I think partly that like all my capacities are stretched to roughly the right limit, and that feels really good. That helps. I think when you're understretched in some areas and overstretched in others, questions about meaning and purpose tend to climb in. And I think it's really, really satisfying to realize that real people are getting less sick because of the stuff that we do. I think that's quite enough meaning to be going on with. It's a good reason to get out of bed.
Hi. So you mentioned the pit of despair and some of those challenges. I'm wondering, what are some of the things that you learned from, you know, those challenging experiences in growing a company, and maybe how some of your values or ideals have changed and what you've gained from those difficult experiences?
Yeah. So I think when in the pit of despair, this is actually, I think, from Alcoholics Anonymous or somewhere like that, that there's a four-letter acronym for when you're most likely to want to drink if you're an alcoholic, or just generally to not feel so good. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. HALT. For me, that HALT acronym was when I think my company's going to fail. Am I hungry? Am I angry? Am I lonely? Am I tired? Often we translate immediate concerns into existential despair much too easily. And I think having a real period of despair in your life where you don't necessarily think that the thing that you're dedicating yourself to is going to work teaches you to modulate that switch. And I think that's a really, really powerful thing to carry forward. I'm a lot more zen about a lot of things than I used to be. I was actually irrationally extremely nervous to do this because I spent a lot of time when I was a master's student fantasizing about being invited back to PI to give a keynote. obviously, I thought it would have been about something completely different, but being able to kind of modulate stress and modulate distress is something it's a real key to happiness in life. It's just being able to be like, oh, I'm really hungry right now, or I'm a bit mad at this person, not my life is falling apart. And I think a bit of hardship that helps with that.
So from what you said, I understand there's a lot of arranging of expectations that's going always in life. Could you explain that more? Like, how do you arrange your expectation? How much you keep it? Like, of course, you started wanted to like change, like create an impact, and then like you were like at some point like, this is the burden that I can pick and move on with. So, can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's So I think the question is, at what point do you start to manage expectations about how much you can get done in the world? I should confess at this point that I did just say blood test for cancer, so maybe I'm not the best person to ask about this. But I think there is a real balance between like knowing vaguely where you're aiming at with your life. The thing that I want to be a force multiplier for in as much as I can is human health and flourishing, and I've kind of just decided that's what I want to do with my time. And kind of have that like off in the distance, but then also just really get up every day and do the dishes. And it's your life is 98% admin and 2% these moments, as I think somebody else also said, where you get to get up on stage and make a big fuss about it. And also really, really enjoying, I really enjoy my day-to-day. And I think if you can enjoy your day-to-day, it doesn't matter quite so much if you achieve your end goal as long as you're trying. I think it's always extremely, extremely dangerous to say, I'm going to make my life really, really rubbish in the short to medium term so I can achieve this thing that I think is going to stroke my ego particularly. I think that's like a dangerous road because ego strokes last about 20 minutes and then you're back to baseline. Rather pick something you're going to want to do every day. Okay, I think you've, oh, wait. I was about to say you've done well enough, but you're exceeding expectations.
So there's this myth that some people in the pharmacy industry will slow down progress of health sciences to keep the money rolling and all this stuff. Is this true?
I mean, I can't unequivocally say no. Okay. I mean, absolutely anything's possible.
Yeah.
My experience of science and pharma and biotech is that everyone's good people trying their best, and I think never put down to malice what bureaucracy can explain. This is more or less like things move very slowly for bureaucratic reasons, which is frustrating as a startup who would like things to move very quickly. But I've never come across a single sniff of malice anywhere in pharma or anywhere in biotech. Everyone's really trying to help.